teach discipline, because motivation is this fleeting little idea. It's a feeling that you have. If you just, something is worth doing and you decide to put your effort towards it, then you need to think about the discipline it takes to get that done. And if you're going to get it done, then discipline will get you there, not motivation. Because you know what? Sometimes things are hard and motivation is not going to be there, but discipline will always be there.
You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Mahatma Gandhi: "The best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others." My guest today and friend Jimmy May is not only a retired Navy SEAL commander, but also a renowned figure in leadership and combat ethics training. With over 22 years of distinguished service, including 7 deployments in the Middle East, Commander May has earned various honors, including 3 Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart. Jimmy's post-military journey is equally as impressive, marked by his roles as CEO of Sushi Assassin, Mayday Executive Services, and the nonprofit Beyond the Brotherhood. Texas A&M alum and a Harvard graduate, he's known for his expertise in creating top-tier teams through intense shared experiences. Fluent in Arabic and passionate about spearfishing, surfing, martial arts, and beekeeping, he resides in beautiful San Diego, as I just saw, doing good things for good people. Jimmy, welcome. It's great to have you on the Elevate Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, as I told you, I'm still sore from our workout back in May that we did. I think that was like 200 push-ups, 200 sit-ups, and I failed at the tightrope, but it was fun.
It's supposed to be fun.
So I like to start at the beginning. I think a lot of time childhood experiences kind of intentionally or unintentionally lead us down, and early influences lead us down the path. What about your childhood might have led us to believe that you would have joined the Navy SEALs one day?
No, I don't have a lot. My parents were both nurses, and we came from really modest upbringing, and most of my family didn't do super well in the military. A lot of them got thrown out for alcohol-related incidents or drugs and stuff. So I think the biggest thing that sticks out to me is when I was in third grade, there was this kid, his name was Teddy. I remember his last name too, but I'll leave it off. He came on our street. He was in sixth grade and we were playing football. And I remember he was being real rough with us and we all kind of had enough. And I stood up to Teddy and he beat me up. And then as he was walking away, I got up off the ground and I went and to fight him again. And he beat me up again. On the third try, after he beat me up, I got up and chased him and he ran off the street. And I remember thinking, interesting. There's something there. And my friends were horrified. And I don't know, just something in me was a little bit different. So I think that's the only thing I can really think of. I definitely had a different trajectory after that.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of people have a moment like that. I actually thought you were more going to say beat you up a third time. And then a lot of people declare that's never going to happen again. And then that leads them into martial arts or something else like that. But
no. Well, no. Well, I definitely got into those. I was a big wrestler and I got into the martial arts. It's part of being on the warrior path that you're on. You need to be able to fight armed or unarmed. So I've been on that path for a long time.
So what did you go to undergraduate to study? What was your plan?
Out of high school, I enlisted in the military and I got a scholarship to go. So I went to college. I really just didn't want to be in the military anymore. I didn't care about what I studied. So I went there under the guise of I was supposed to be studying biology, but I ended up switching to construction. And I just like construction management, which is like a business degree. So 5.5 short years at Texas A&M, I had a 4-year degree.
So you were enrolled, enlisted the whole time?
I was enlisted. So back then, they let you out of your enlistment to go to college, and then you had to come back in. But they really didn't have any strings on you, so a lot of people would get out of it. And so they've changed the program since then. Now they maintain your enlistment. But during that time, I was actually not enlisted anymore.
How did you find your way to Navy SEALs, which I think everyone knows, but pretty much one of the more elite units in the U.S. military or military around the world? Is that like a progression? Do you start at something or do you go right into that? I guess I don't even know when most are people, how old are they when most people go through BUDS?
So you have to be between the ages of 18 and 28. You can get a waiver to 30, but we grant, I used to be the executive officer at BUDS and during that, for sure. And we granted 11 waivers during the 2.5 years I was there for the people up under 30, but over 28, not a single one made it. It's just your body cannot heal fast enough once you get a couple of years on you. Back to your original question, what got me into it? So I got to Texas A&M and I was in the Corps of Cadets, which was, it's kind of like a frat / ROTC combination. Not everyone there is going to go to the military and I hated it. I didn't like getting yelled at by upperclassmen who didn't had never been in the military, telling me about the military, where I just came from the military. So I definitely had a bad attitude. I was just looking for something difficult. And I went to see my uncle, who was did pretty well in the Navy. He was retired as a warrant officer. And he said, I was like, is there anything hard? Because I felt like the Navy was dumb. And then I went to college. I never went to class. I had like a 3.6 GPA. I thought college was dumb. And I'm like, what's hard? And my uncle, he looked at me and he goes, you know, the SEALs are hard, but you shouldn't do it. And I'm like, why? He goes, well, you won't make it. I'm like, why won't I make it? He goes, nobody makes it. I'm like, oh, that's it. That's all it was. That little spark of my uncle.
Someone telling you you can't do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why I did it.
Well, so I guess it's called Hell Week, but it's multiple weeks, right? Which is called BUDS, which is the process of the training, which very few people make it out. I looked at some different numbers. It's about 10 to 20% I've read, but I thought it was less than that. How many people make it through all 3 weeks?
Yeah, I think we bill it as 10 to 15% make it, but it's actually harder than that because it's hard to get a slot to go.
These are the best of the best to start too.
Yeah. I mean, our officers are all Ivy League guys. 70% of our enlisted guys all have degrees. Most of them have like advanced degrees. It's just, it's very hard to get in. So just that initial culling process happens. Then when they get in, they get into BUDS. You got to perform or you get knocked out pretty quick. And it's one of the few places that has hard and fast standards still. I feel like there's always wiggle room for everybody.
Yeah, there's been no watering down of the standards there.
No, there hasn't been. And I think that the tribute to the guys that run that program, because there's definitely been a lot of effort to try and make it. I used to be the executive officer there. And so I could see people being like, this is a waste of time. You're only getting this finite amount of people. It's such an expensive program, but you want them to do these kind of jobs. These are the kind of people you need.
So you were an instructor later on.
I was not an instructor. I was the executive officer. So we have 250 staff in cadre and then about 400 to 600 students at any one time. And so I ran them. I'd never sent a single person to the surf. And I don't really yell at people. I just don't do that. You can ask my kids. That's not my thing.
What is the surf?
Oh, the surf. Sorry. It's a ubiquitous term in my circles, but
it sounds like jail the way you used it, but yeah.
Yeah. The Pacific Ocean is usually between 55 and sometimes it gets as warm as like 69 degrees. And when they say hit the surf, it's always there crashing. You spend a lot of your time wet. In fact, during Hell Week, if you're not running, you're shivering. If you're not shivering, you're carrying something heavy. It's pretty much, that's what you do the whole time.
I'm curious your take on it. I remember, I don't know if you read Angela Duckworth's book, Grit.
I have not read it, but I've heard some stuff about her.
So she did some research on BUDS and tried to figure out, like, was there data on who would make it through, and people would guess who would make it through. And they looked at physical ability or specimen or whatever. And basically the conclusion from everything she looked at was the people who said that they weren't going to quit. That was the closest correlation. It wasn't the person you would have guessed was the strongest. Like, I'm curious. So with this thing, is probably the hardest initiation in the world. What was your experience? Did you ever feel like you're going to quit? And do you feel like you can pick who's going to make it?
First of all, I can absolutely not who's going to make it. Like, we tried. I was there for 2.5 years.
Yeah. She tried all these studies and everyone's tried.
Oh yeah. We did tons of studies trying to figure out. There's a couple things we found weird correlations, but we found a couple things. But for the most part, you really can't tell. And your first question, did I ever think about quitting? No, I didn't. And I've heard people say, everyone thinks about quitting. I didn't. I always was waiting for the thing that I couldn't do. And it just never happened. And it surprised me how many people were quitting around me, because they quit during things that you wouldn't think are that big of a deal. Like when you filled a mask with water and they're doing like flutter kicks. We had 3 guys quit.
Like Michael Phelps won a gold medal. He couldn't see through his goggles. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. These guys. Yeah. People quit for weird things. The number one quitting evolution in all of BUDS, evening chow. It just makes no sense, because guys get in there, they get comfortable, they got some warm water in them. Then they walk outside and there's a fire hose blasting people and they're wet and they got to pick up the boats and people just quit in droves.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? 2 years ago, I bought a dual suspension mountain bike for the first time, and it pushed me to ride trails that I had never been willing to try before. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has exceptional capability that will have you seeing the possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. The Lexus GX comes with available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, best-in-class towing capacity, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. I've seen the new Lexus GX popping up all around my town, and not only does it have the capabilities to take you to new places on and off the road, but it's a great-looking car. The new Lexus GX is ready to raise the bar for you. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. With everyone fighting for attention these days, how can you get your business to stand out and connect with customers? It's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media postings, and even event management. You'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track your growth. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence, knowing that your emails are actually reaching your customers, thanks to their best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. Constant Contact was actually the first email marketing platform I ever used almost 20 years ago, and it's a testament to the product's quality that it's still the standard for email marketing today. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Yeah, you've talked about this, and I think there's some interesting kind of leadership lesson on standards. And the reason why the standards have not been changed or can't be changed is because this is not like fraternity house just enjoying hazing and enjoying the suffering of others. This is mimicking the most difficult conditions possibly in the world that you would have to be in. And I know all of the lifting and moving and carrying the logs is about getting your brother's dead body out of a compromised situation. So for the job that needs to be done or the standards that need to be done, it can't be changed. And I feel like in a lot of families and companies and stuff today, the standards are lowered and it's still, but the objective hasn't changed. And again, it's not an ideological thing. It's a real world necessity thing.
Yeah. And I'm not one that says standards have to always be the same.
Yeah.
In 20 years, we have metal legs and we don't need to be this strong. But for right now, they made us key when they came through the Women in Service Review, which is this thing where they try to have, they wanted to, hey, let's make it okay for women to come in, which women can apply now. But they were like, we want to go evolution by evolution through the entire buds. And I want you to show me how this correlates to actual warfare. And we did it. And we actually came out, buds is actually a little bit easier than it should be. Because all the stuff that these young kids are doing, they're doing slick, which means they might be wet and cold, but they're not carrying anything. And like, I can go through my old logs of how much weight I carried walking out the door. And the least weight I ever carried was 81 pounds. And the most weight I carried was 139 pounds. So you're running around the battlefield, offset inserts, which means you got to walk 5 to 7 kilometers before you get to the target. With that kind of weight on, you have to be big and strong to do it. So right now, the standards have been validated, and I'm all for updating the standards if what we need on the backside changes. But right now, we still need people that can swim multiple miles, then take off their stuff, then walk multiple miles, carrying a ton of weight, and then run an assault. And then leave. Like, these are hard, physically tough evolutions we need people to be able to do.
So as I mentioned before, you were 7 tours of duty in the Middle East. You were in the thick of this. Navy SEALs were a lot of part of the door-to-door fighting. And then you also held leadership roles both in the SEALs and obviously you spent a lot of your time kind of coaching leaders outside. I know this is very broad, let's narrow it down, but I'm curious, what are some of the core frameworks that you learned during your time from this life and death work that you think that really apply to leadership anywhere and that people would be well served to understand them, particularly around decision-making, chaos? I think we've had a crazy couple years, right, up and down, and everyone's exhausted and tired and having to lead in difficult times, many people for the first time, and they're struggling. So I can't think of anyone better. This can be a 10-minute answer if you want. I know you have a bunch of different frameworks to kind of talk about what we could learn from your leadership during those intense times.
Well, I think that step one is being prepared. I am always prepared. When I show up, I always show up early. All my stuff, it just makes me feel good. And I teach that to my son now. He's going to be an ambassador for his school. I'm like, hey, listen, if you really want this, then you need to prepare. Showing up the most prepared, there's nothing bad about that. And if you don't get it, then it's not because you didn't try. And so being overly prepared and taking that time to prepare for something important is step one. Then if you're a member of a team, focus on your team and your role on that team. So lots of times we want to focus on what we're good at, but sometimes, especially as you get more senior, so like I was really good assaulter and now I moved up into a leadership role, I still want to go assault, but the team needs me to lead. And so what I need to do is focus on my teammates, making sure they have what they need to assault. And I think taking that spotlight off yourself is very important, because whenever you get into that realm of worrying about yourself, and you're not thinking about the bigger picture. So I think the last thing I would say, I think just those two things. We'll leave it at that. So number one, be overly prepared. And number two, focus on the team and your role in it.
I heard a quote this morning, actually. I was listening to Morgan Housel's new book. I love his. He's focused on, I can't remember the name now, but it's basically on things that stay the same while everything else changes. Like, he's focused on what stays.
I just listened to his podcast on that yesterday. I listened to it twice. It was really good. Yeah.
He's one of the best writers, I think, of today. I think him and Derek Thompson. But he talks a lot about in financial preparation, and he might have been talking about Munger, but he said, everyone's so busy forecasting, just be prepared. He's like, the forecasts are never right. You don't know when. He's like, no one forecast COVID-19. No one forecast Great Depression. No one forecast the recent war that we're having. But if you get caught unprepared, that's on you. He's basically saying the forecast will never be right. So preparation. So it's interesting tie to that. And he was also, the things that would stay the same were basically all the human miscalculations of hubris and fear and overconfidence. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I really enjoyed that one. Yeah, I think preparedness, and then like we do a lot of contingency planning. So like we'll look at the op, and then what we'll do is the guys will sit down and they'll think about what can go wrong at every step of the way in the op. And we break it down by like insert, which is however you get dropped off. And then infill is infiltration, whether you're walking to it or you're driving to it, whatever. And then we have like the actions on, and then we have exfil, which is like leaving the target, and then extract, which is when you're actually getting picked up by the helicopter or boats or however you're leaving. So we break it down by that, and we go step by step, what could go wrong? And then we have mitigation plans for all those things that we could possibly think of, because we can't eliminate risk. And I think that one of the things I like about the Entrepreneurs Organization is that that group of people is very comfortable. Risk is not something that can be eliminated, but we mitigate it, we plan for it, and then we thrive in that environment because other people aren't. And that's kind of what we do in the teams with our contingency planning. So every single thing you can think about, you stack your assets. Maybe we're breaking like one of the big three rules of land warfare for a moment. We don't break it out of ignorance, because you can break rules, but you don't break them out of ignorance. You know what you're getting, how long you're doing it, and you tell the people who set those rules that you're breaking those rules during those times. And those are important things to know when it comes time, because when something does go wrong, everyone knows what the plan is for it. And sometimes some unforeseen things do go wrong, but for the most part, you've got contingencies in place for everything you thought of already, and some of those will work for this new contingency that just showed up.
Yeah, we had General McChrystal on the podcast. One of his best quotes, I think, ever is that if you get there and the situation is different, then don't execute the order I gave you, execute the order I should have given you.
Yeah, I'm actually a huge McChrystal fan. When he started the McChrystal Group, he hired a bunch of Navy SEALs to work for him, a bunch of guys I knew.
That doesn't surprise me. So when you talk about that, to me, this is one of the biggest things. I know people don't like sports analogies, or a lot, maybe half the people don't. But I think in leadership, they're pretty instructive. And what you described, and I think what the military does and what sports teams do so much better than, let's just say, parents and organizations, is there's the playing field, right? And you spend time in the playing field, but there's the time you spend before you get on the playing field, talk about what you're going to face, what you're going to do otherwise. And then there's the time after, you know, on the playing field where you recap and talk about what you're going to do next time. But the coach never crosses the line, never gets on the field, never goes on there. When I think about parenting today and a lot of leadership, it's just like jumping on the field, taking the ball out of the hand, getting into the play, when real leadership should be before and after and let the game play out. And I just feel like I think there are organic behaviors and consequences and relationships between those. And if they were sort of electrical currents that you have to figure out, and we're just short circuiting those. And so people don't learn them and feel them for themselves. And consequences isn't always negative. Sometimes it's positive. So what are your thoughts on what, particularly, again, I'd say parenting and organization can learn from this sort of pre-prep and post-prep versus getting involved in the actual event?
Yeah, that's a really cool question, because like nowadays you see like online, you watch a TikTok or you watch Instagram, and all it is the cool jump the guy's doing, or the cool thing that the culmination of years of experience and hard work and training.
Right. The ping pong balls that hit all the things, they must have had 400 tries before they did that, right?
Yeah. They don't show you all of that lead up to it. And so I think that it's important, especially as like a parent. In my family, we do some pretty cool stuff. We spend a lot of time dirt bike riding or camping way off the grid or surfing or spearfishing. We do lots of things, but there's a lot of prep that goes into it. And you have to learn to embrace that prep and enjoy it. Like, I love messing with I have a giant gear room downstairs, and it is meticulously organized, and everything is clean and rinsed and right where I know it is. It just makes me happy to go down there and spend 2 or 3 hours messing with gear. And so when I have a for-profit business called Mayday Executive, where I do excursions for executives, and they just get the tip of that iceberg. You know, they don't see me prepping the bags of wetsuits and making sure that all of the gear is perfect. They don't see all that, but my son sees all that. He helps me with a lot of these events. And so he sees all of that hard work. And then I go out for 6 or 8 hours. We take the guys spearfishing or skydiving or whatever it is I'm doing. Then we come back, and then those guys go and they have a dinner. And then I go back, and me and my son clean and prep the gear and get it nice again. And that in the video that they take from what the photographer takes of the event we had just shows them doing this crazy fun stuff. And there's a montage and a cool song, but they don't see me with a toothbrush scrubbing a spark plug on the side, or, you know, cleaning out that mask or making sure that there's toothpaste. They don't see all that, but my son gets to see all that. And he knows how much work these things are. So I think that it's a cool balance to not only have your organization see it, but teach that as part of the joy. Like, when I walk down and I look into my garage and it's just like lined up, perfect gear set up, it just makes me happy. It's just part of it.
Hey, Elevate listeners. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify is the partner you need to keep the cash register ringing for your e-commerce business. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading platforms. I advise a lot of companies in the e-commerce space, and almost all of them have migrated to Shopify. And as a buyer, what I love about buying from Shopify-enabled sites is that they already know who I am, and I don't have to create a new account or enter all my payment info. The Shop Pay service makes it faster and easier to buy, which surely helps with conversions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/elevate, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/elevate now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/elevate. What needs to change? I would argue probably everything you did in leadership in the Navy SEALs was under some basic form of duress that would cripple most people. And I found like it's confusing because you see a lot of leaders who are great. They're great when things are going well, and then they completely collapse when some stress is applied. Like, what can we learn from that? How can we train differently? How do you figure that out with someone before they have that moment? Because again, I think the last 3-4 years, supply shock, demand shock, everything's been hard. Nothing's been easy. And you're seeing a lot of people really wilt when what you guys did was just, it was never going to be. Integrity is also one of those things that seems really easy when there's easy choices. And then it gets a lot harder for some people when pressure is applied.
Well, we have this saying in the teams that goes, everyone wants to be a frogman when it's sunny outside at the bar and the girls want to know what you do for a living. But when it's time to get in the cold, scary water and it's something's going wrong, there's water in your mask, it's not so much fun to be a frogman. So the question was, how do we train to get to that level?
How do you train? How do you know that? Should it be part of leadership development? If you're trying to pick a leader for your organization, how would you want to know how that person does in a difficult situation? I just think I've seen people change so dramatically, not everyone, but a large percentage, while some remain consistent. It seems like until the water boils a little bit, it's very hard to discern that.
Yeah. So for me, if we're trying to choose somebody, we set up a whole interview process for a SEAL officer assessment and selection called SOAS. It's kind of an acronym, but that's what it is. And we don't ask what they would do, because you can always say, oh, I would do this great thing. But you ask about what they did do, about past experiences, because that's the best predictor of the future. And we ask questions like, when's the time you failed? And then as you start pulling the string on when they failed, you can tell, are they blaming other people for it? Is it not their fault? Was it a I'm a victim of circumstance. I was the third leader that took this over and it was already failing. Like, if they're putting it on other people, then number one, they didn't learn anything. Number two, they're making excuses. And number three, if you can't own something, then you're never going to fix it. So what we look for is that person that ideally we score them on a 1 through 5. So ideally they can bring up something they failed at. If they can't bring up something they failed at, you know, they're a waste of my time. Number two, what did they learn from it? Did they learn from that failure? Number three, what did they do after they learned it? Did they do something to make themselves better? You want to score a fourth point. Did they do something to make their immediate team better? Like, okay, not only did I disagree with my boss in a bad way, but then I took a class about how to disagree with my boss. And then after that, I taught my platoon how to disagree with their boss. So now we're at a 4-point answer. A 5-point answer is really hard to get, but that would be like you did something outside of your immediate circle. So then I started How to Disagree with Your Boss Anonymous, and we are now in 39 states and 43 locations. And like that would be like a high answer. And so someone that can look at a situation that they did poorly at, accept that they had a blame in it, take steps to mitigate that so it doesn't happen again next time, and then share it forward. So that's what I'm looking for guys, for great leaders.
Yeah, and that's totally transferable, I would say, all of those things to private sector. A lot of leaders are, again, I think they're struggling right now. I think it's been hard. It's been choppy for a while. There's no easy out. You just have to go through it. Like, what advice would you give to a leader or a board who's dealing with kind of a motivation issue of people just feeling like this has just been hard for 3 years and it's not fun? I don't know if I want to do it anymore. But again, there's not anything easier else to jump in. Someone was telling me yesterday they were coming from a meeting with 8 professionals in 8 different industries. And the number one consensus was it just was so much harder to do the same thing than it was 2 to 3 years ago.
Yeah. If you're a world-class organization, whatever you're doing, you should be striving to be, then adversity is opportunity. Because what's going to happen is, let's say it's this really easy industry. Let's just say interest rates are low and everyone's flipping houses and selling houses and buying and selling houses. All of a sudden, interest rates come up right now like they are now. And if you're a world-class organization, you're going to be okay. But what's going to happen is it's going to thin that herd. It's going to cull out the lesser, the little random house flippers and all these people who are like just coming on and they're going to have to go do something else. But if you're world-class, you welcome that adversity. You want it. Yeah, bring it on. Because you know what? We're going to put in the processes. We've got the solid people and we're going to make it through this. And then on the backside of this, when interest rates come down and the house rate starts to take off again, guess who's going to be well-positioned to really own this? So I think adversity is not a bad thing. I think that if you prepare for it and you're ready for it and you think about it, then fine. It's going to affect some people. But you know, I always say, I don't care who's elected president or what's going on with the government or any of that. You know what? Me and my family are going to be squared away and we're going to be ready. We'll be ready to thrive in whatever kind of environment you throw us into. We'll figure it out.
It sounded a little like the Stockdale paradox when you were saying that, in terms of this notion of confront the brutal realities while maintaining kind of a long-term vision of getting through it. You need both of those things. I think a lot of people during difficult times, if you just tell everyone it's going to suck and it's going to be horrible, whatever, I mean, why stay on the mission? Versus if you are too rosy and don't address the realities of what's going on, then their confidence will be broken that way. So it's a delicate balancing act.
No, I agree with that. I haven't heard about the Stockdale paradox.
Oh, you have to look that one up. That was actually one of my most popular Friday Fords ever. It was Admiral Stockdale who was so Jim Collins pulled that story out of him in Good to Great. And Collins asked him about, I think he was a hostage for 7 years. And when Collins asked him, well, who didn't make it first, or sort of who gave up first? And he said, though, that was easy. That was the optimist. And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, they just always thought they were going to be out by Christmas or out by the next thing. And then when it came, they just couldn't handle it. And they kind of died of a broken heart. He's like, I always knew I was going to get out. I always knew whatever, but I was very honest with the brutal realities of the situation. And that, I think, was the difference.
You know, something else you said earlier, you talked about motivation and it's hard. Like, I don't teach motivation at all. If people call me like, hey, we need a motivation, I'm like, that's not me. You got the wrong guy. I teach discipline, because motivation is this fleeting little idea. It's a feeling that you have. If you just, something is worth doing and you decide to, you know, put your effort towards it, then you need to think about the discipline it takes to get that done. And if you're going to get it done, then discipline will get you there, not motivation. Because you know what? Sometimes things are hard and motivation is not going to be there, but discipline will always be there.
Yeah, it's very hard to motivate other people. My friend Brad Peterson, whose episode released this week, who's had a boom bust incredible story. His dad always told him his number one thing. I think he had it assigned. You can pay one of two prices, the price of discipline or the price of regret. So I thought you might like that. So talk to me about the importance of language skills, both in military and civilian career, particularly Arabic. How important was it to you to sort of assimilate into cultures or people that you were working with on missions that were complicated and I think door to door in some case?
Yeah, so I didn't want to learn Arabic. I went kicking and screaming. I took some tests and they're like, hey, you can apparently learn languages. And I actually didn't score high enough to get into Arabic because you had to score a 110. I got a 109 and they're like, he's a SEAL. He's the closest we got. Let's do it. So they sent me to this thing. I thought I was going to miss the whole war. So I was studying as hard as I could, just trying to get out of there because I wanted to get back to work. And so I did a 16-month course. I did it in 13 months, tested out and went overseas. And it was gave me a unique niche because all of our guys can, they're all fast, strong, they can shoot, they can do all those things, but they didn't have anybody who was a SEAL that could actually speak. And so when you have an interpreter, they don't know what to look for. Like they don't know what's the kind of thing that they should be listening for. And I mean, I look pretty German. My parents, both my grandmas were born in Germany. So no one thinks I speak Arabic. And plus I don't look super intelligent. So I lead the league in looking dumb. So they would just, the Iraqi soldiers that didn't know I spoke, the interpreters, it really gave me a unique niche that I could offer because I knew what was going on when not everybody did. And the graffiti was very important because they would mark IEDs by graffiti. I could read what it said, even though most of the soldiers couldn't read. Even if I didn't know the words, I could say them out loud and then they could tell me what they mean. So it gave me a unique niche. And I mean, when it came time to do negotiations for stuff, all I had to do was kick off the negotiation with, I forgot my interpreter. Can we use yours? And so now they're just going carte blanche around the table, just spilling, making fun of me and how stupid I am and all this stuff. I'm just sitting there with my dumb look on my face, but I know what's going on.
I assume there was some value and you have some stories about making a connection with a local and speaking with them, connecting, but half the value was being underestimated. Sounds like. So you would ask for the interpreter. They would pre-discuss before the interpreter. You'd know what they were saying. And that's fascinating.
It was huge. That was great for negotiation. Yeah.
Would you ever tip your hand at the end or no?
No, I normally did not tip my hand because I knew when I was going to be back. And when I come back, I want to maintain that skill that nobody else has. So I normally did not tip my hand. My first deployment with being an Arabic speaker, I ended up doing a lot of like combat interpreter. So I would show up and I would place the soldiers where they needed to be. And so obviously they knew I could speak, but I found it was a lot better even for like interrogations and stuff because I could be standing there next to prisoners. They think I'm just a guard. And they're sitting there talking back and forth to each other. And I'm getting all the information I need without even having to say anything to them. So it was a really good skill to have.
We had a core value at our company, excel and improve. And what I would always say was, I don't think you can be excellent without improving, right? There are certain standards and things that you need to say the same, but you need to objectively look at something and see if it's got a problem or a hole or make it better. One of the stories you told in one of the sessions we were in kind of stuck with me around, because it seemed like you were part of a lot of leadership improvements in the SEALs. And I'm sure it's really hard to change some of these because you get to like, oh, they're getting soft and this is what we did and all this stuff. But one of the ones you talked about, and you're right, these are people, right, this is a higher standard, was that there was no transition when you would leave. And so you could be on the field in Iraq, fighting for your life, killing people, and then 48 hours be at a bar in San Diego. And I assume some guy tries to take your chair and you might end up killing him, right? So this was something that you said you had identified during your time you saw, and then there was active work to change it. Can you share a little more about that?
Yeah, I think where they got this from was like back in World War II, those guys saw some crazy war. I mean, crazier stuff than I've ever seen. They were just running into machine guns. It was the tactics back then hadn't caught up to technology. And so those guys would, on the way back, they would jump on a boat and take the boat back across. Now they're like kind of together chilling for 7 to 10 days, however long that Atlantic would take to get back. And then they were decompressed a bit when they came home. So for us, I mean, at one time I was 36 hours out of a gunfight when I was dropped off in San Diego with a hole in my chest and my family had left me and I was just basically standing there on the edge, not sure what I was going to do. And so I went to a bar and then I think I either went home with the girl or I slept in my cage for the next couple weeks until the workup started again. So that's probably not a good place to be. So there's a lot of improvement that can happen there. And what I saw they started doing later on was this thing called TLD, third location decompression, which I didn't think was the greatest idea at the time, just like most good ideas, you don't realize it, but they would take people and they put them in a different country, maybe Germany or something where we've got like some American presence, and let the guys kind of go out and have talk to a psych, talk to a chaplain, and then they get a little time to blow off steam with each other before they go home. And I think that was a pretty good thing. When I first heard it, I was like, great, these guys haven't seen a woman in 6 months and they haven't drank a beer in 6 months and we're going to turn them loose to some city. But it turned out to be a pretty good thing. I think that's a much better thing to do than 36 hours out of gunfight at a bar in San Diego. You know what I mean? Having to repack a hole in my chest before I go out.
So. Yeah, and I think for a lot of us in working from home or otherwise, it's not the same level, but we need these transitions. I think a lot of our lives used to be more compartmentalized, right? Work was here and home was here, and it's all kind of a mess now. And I think I said this when companies started working from home, I think a lot of people didn't miss the actual commute, but they needed a virtual commute. They needed 6 o'clock to go for a walk or take the dog and actually transition environments. I think that's been a challenge for people.
Yeah, I work from home largely now, and I found that like it ends up bleeding into my personal time a lot more. Like I probably put in tons and tons of hours. I get up at 4:30. I'm like, oh, I guess I'll just get to work. And then maybe I'll bounce out and get a workout or a surf. And then I come back and I work. And then, oh, no one's home. It's dinner time. I'll work. So I didn't work in. I don't really pay attention to what day it is. I just get up. And if I have work, I do it. I think it was a lot cleaner, especially before, because everything was done at least a secret level or above. So I didn't actually, sometimes I had a secret hookup in my house, but having to like work there and not being able to bring that work home with you was actually kind of nice because I could get home and actually relax. And I think now the way I do that is I go off the grid all the time. This last weekend I was in Mexico. If my phone works, I turn it off. But most of the time I'm aware that when my phone doesn't work. And then you can really be there and present with your family. And that's a powerful thing. I would never take the time in San Diego to just sit and, I don't know, goof off with my family like I did in Mexico, because there's nothing else to do but goof off. And so I really value my time off the grid.
We'll have to get to, I'm sure you'll tell as we transition, where it is that you are, that there's no cell phone service all the time. So you retired in air quotes in January 2023, although you've probably never been busier. What the transition to military life to civilian life has got to have some challenges. I also assume you saw that coming for a few years. And so maybe we're mentally preparing for it. How have you managed that transition from doing this one thing for so long to not doing it?
You know, the hardest transition for me was to go from the tactical to operational level of war. So my first 14 years, I never missed a deployment. I was always on the ground with the guys. And then in 2017, I went to Buds, was my first shore tour. And I was like, hey guys, I don't do shore tours. You got the wrong guy. And they were like, no, you need to. You've been on the line for a long time. So they put me in, they were right. I was just in a different head state. You can't go to that many deployments in a row and not be a different person. So it was good for me. But then I had my little existential crisis there because I went back to Mosul for the big Mosul fight, but I was the deputy commander. So I was second in charge of all special operations. And
you were the coach. You couldn't step onto the field.
Yeah. But I didn't know that. So I'm like, hey, I'm going to go on op. I'm like, no one can tell me no because I'm the boss. So I go on this op. And it was really weird. The guys were like, hey, sir, just sit right there. I'm like, no. You want me to drive? What do you want me to do? You know, and they're like, just sit right there. I'm like, oh. I'm a combat tourist. That's not what I'm supposed to be. Like, so I realized that was when I went through my crisis. I'm like, okay, I don't like doing this. I wanted to be in the tactical level. So I started prepping to get out. I went to business school and I started learning a little bit about the civilian world. And then the most important thing for anybody making a transition, it doesn't matter what it is, find a mentor. And like Steve Gattina, who you know, and the guys at Pray.com just took me under their wing. I don't know why. They asked me to come do an event for him. So I went and did it. And they were like, hey, can we pay you? I'm like, no, you can't pay me. That's not what I do for a living. I was like, but I could use a mentor. Would you do that? And they were like, what does that mean? I'm like, if I get confused or scared, I get to call you. And then once a month, let's have a Zoom call or something. That was it. That was the best investment I've made in my entire life. Those guys, I talked to them now. I probably texted Steve 10 times already today. We are always at the constant conversation. And he helped me make that transition to civilian world. So not just military to civilian, but whatever transition you're going.
Right. If you're going down a road, find someone who's further down the road. That's always been my trick. So you've started a plethora of businesses in your brief retirement. The first is Sushi Assassin, which is a fascinating name. Tell us about that one.
So when I got to business school, I actually started it like in 2018, just because I had this new business school muscle. You got to flex it. You know what I mean? Like you can't learn something to do it. You have to do it. So I didn't know what kind of business to start. And I had a friend that knew how to make sushi. I'm like, let's do this in-home sushi catering, low overhead, As long as I'm in the black, I don't care. I just want to get used to running a business. But he's done great. I'm super proud of this guy. He's just done a great job. His name is Aaron Bishop, and I'd like to hand the business off to him because I don't really take money from it.
You go into people's houses and make it?
Oh, yeah. So if you're in the San Diego area, they will show up. Costs about the same as going to a restaurant, to be completely honest. They show up in your house, have a whole sushi kitchen, all you can eat sushi. If you want to have drinks there, COVID was great for us because you want to take a PCR test. No one knows how to make sushi.
Well, also you got the weather where they have to sit outside, it's fine, right?
Yeah, but it's not super lucrative because sushi is like, you got to have tight margins and fish goes bad. You can only have it for a couple of days if you're going to use it. So when we make money is when we spear a bunch of fish or something. That's when we really make it.
That's very cool. Too bad you don't do Boston, do you? We could use that here.
No, I think that's a long way to go. I mean, there's a price tag for anything, right? But that'd be...
Franchise. All right. So then we got Mayday Executive Services. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah. So Mayday Exec is just this blanket company that sometimes I do keynote. I teach. You guys have been around for resilience talk and then also leading organizational change. And then also I do executive adventures. So whatever someone you want to jump out of a plane, you want to shoot a 200-pound fish, you want to learn how to do J-turns, you want to blow up a car, like I can figure it out and I'll do it wherever you want me to do it. So I think I've got a YPO group coming up in March that I'm going to kidnap them. It's really fun.
So walk through this. So do they not know that this is happening? Has one guy in the group, woman, set up the other people?
No. People have to know they're going to be kidnapped.
Okay.
But there's a lot of facets to it. Like I'm going to teach them how to escape from I'll teach them how to pick handcuffs and locks and how to get zip ties and how to get a tape.
I learned the zip tie one. It's interesting. Is that with the shoelaces?
You can do it with the shoelace. Yeah. It's called shimming.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can do it that way. Anyway, I'll teach them how to do all this stuff. And then when I put them in an interrogation, we'll interrogate them. And then on the backside, I'll let them try and escape. And we'll score the groups based on how far out they can get from their escape in like 10 minutes or whatever I decide. So it's going to be pretty cool. So I do stuff like that with Mayday Executive. It's like whatever you want. And I don't make as much money on the events as I do from the speaking things, but the events are so fun. Like these are things that people are going to remember for the rest of their life. And I get to be part of it.
And it's a lot of corporate teams, right?
Yeah, corporate teams. YPO and EO are big customers. I do a lot with them. But then I've also corporations. I did some stuff this year with Fort Walton Machining and Compass Real Estate and just a bunch of other partners. Yeah.
My four mates are listening to this, but I was thinking it'd be great if I told them that the event was something else and then I had to kidnap all of us. But now I know at least two of them listen to it regularly. So now I'm going to ruin that. But that would be a really fascinating, because the motto is always once in a lifetime experience. And you got to think that that's a once in a lifetime experience.
Well, hopefully it's a once in a lifetime experience. But if it happens again, at least you're more prepared. You would have been.
But there's just little things that my uncle was in YPO for years and they had like a personal family safety kind of weekend or expert come in. And again, one in a million things. But I remember him telling me this story 20 years ago, and it still sticks with me, that if you were in a carjacking, that the most important thing to do is to get your head and body on the pillar. Like in between the two windows, because that's basically where you'd be.
That's not true.
Maybe I heard it wrong, but there was something related to that. But yeah, it's fascinating.
That's not true. The only part of a car that's ballistic protection is pretty much the axles and the engine.
So don't lay back in between the windows?
It'll cut right through there like nothing, yeah.
All right. So do not try this at home. Disclaimers. Take back whatever I said. All right. So we'll talk offline about the form kidnapping. That definitely sounds fascinating. But I think more important for you, close to you, 8 months ago, I saw you wrote a note on LinkedIn about how more of your team members you had lost in the last 12 months outside of battle and how big the mental health crisis was for a lot of veterans. So I know you started Beyond the Brotherhood. Tell us a little bit about what that does.
Yeah, Beyond the Brotherhood is where I spend the preponderance of my time. And within 4 months of my retirement, four of my friends had killed themselves by their own hand.
And they were retired or they were actively deployed?
They're retired. Yeah. One guy was active, but the rest were all retired. And the thing is, they were all good dudes. They weren't turds. It wasn't like, oh, this is a guy that got in trouble or no, they were always the really solid dudes. And I think guys like that, good people think about the repercussions of their actions and the ripple effects they've sent into the world. And I think that it kind of builds on them. And I started really drilling down on what it is. And I think it's they've lost purpose, they've lost goals, and they've lost a community. In the SEAL teams, you've got those things.
Right. And you get them all in the same place, right? Whereas a lot of people might have those things in different parts of their life, and then you lose it all of them at once.
And so what I thought about, how could I do that? How could I provide that for these good dudes coming out? So we have a screening process. We screen and select for the top guys getting out, and we don't take everybody. We just can't. I mean, it's one of those things, you can't just throw money across everybody. You have to like have a couple people you help. So I planned on just doing 3 to 4 a year, but we've got 23 guys. It was just really good dudes coming out, needed help. And so we give them the last bits or whatever they need. Lots of times they have a stale network because I have never had social media till this year. So stale network.
I can see how that wouldn't be super useful in your line of work. Selfie from, you know, yeah.
Yeah, from his predominant college, yeah. But anyway, these guys are coming out and they don't have networks. They've got all these skills, but they don't know how to like talk the talk. Like I went to business school, it was good for me. So what we do is we hook them up with, if they want, a behavior psychologist to kind of like get them squared away on what it is they think they want to do, or where we think they'd be a good fit. And then we start plugging them in. And there's really good programs that we can leverage, like the SOCOM Care Coalition Fellowship or SkillBridge, where we can actually send people out as interns to these companies to get a test drive to see if it fits. And if it doesn't work, we bring them back and we give them another shot. And so if a company wants to hire one of these guys and they tell me, hey, I want a guy that has an MBA and this certification in real estate, I can send them to you with that stuff. And so we take our time with these guys. They need to heal. Lots of guys are broken. I myself have fake hips and I've got a torn labrum and rotator cuff in my shoulder, and our guys are pretty beat up. So we need to give them some time to heal, get their surgeries, get back on track with their family, and then kind of launch them back into the civilian world so that they can take part in some of the prosperity that they help to secure for us. So that's kind of the goal. And I've had to suspend intakes because, like I said, I have so many guys. I've got 8 guys in the hopper right now that I just had to push them off. I'm like, hey, I'm sorry, I don't have the funding. I need to like put in some different processes so we can expand. Because before it was just me doing it, and now it's like, all right, we're growing really fast. I have to like stop and slow down.
So if people are listening to this, like, how can they help? Either obviously financially, but if they feel like they could be a resource or help with the networking or help with the job. I mean, I'd love to have a Navy SEAL working in operations next to me. Where can they learn more?
So beyondthebrotherhood.org is our website. And then if you click on the bottom, it says contact us, and it'll go to either me or my partner, Sean. He's a partner in running this. And we'll look at it, and then we'll email you, and then we'll call you, and we'll figure it out. Like, hey, what's a good fit? Like, you know, if you want to be a donor, if you want to come to an event, our events are really fun. We just did the SSS. Amazing. The next one coming up is the Pit Stop Challenge. It's in North Carolina, where we're going to be doing pit stops on a real NASCAR with the number 3 and the number 8 team out of Richard Childress Racing. Amazing. It's super fun, and you can be involved that way. If you want to be a mentor, you know, take some time one-on-one to get to know these guys and help them. They're high quality, high caliber guys. They just need to learn how to get along in the civilian world.
All right. We'll add that to the show notes too, but sounds like a lot of people listening probably could offer some help. So another thing that's kind of front and center, I think, with particularly what's going on in the Middle East, I know you have kind of a strong philosophy and you teach on combat ethics. Talk to us about your viewpoint on that and how it applies to both military and civilian sectors.
So combat ethics sounds like a contradictory term, but you know, at the end of the day, you have to live with what you do over there. And if you're doing the wrong things, and it's interesting when you go, the rules of engagement, ROE, we'll call them, they change over time. So I've been places where it's like absolutely no civilians killed. Then you go to like the Mosul fight where they were like, they told everyone, if you're not ISIS, get out of here. And then they put a like crazy collateral damage estimate where it was just a big blunt object. And I'm like, that's not really what we do. So getting over these rules of engagement, at the end of the day, you have to do the right thing. So the best thing I can tell you is one time I was on a roof and this guy came out and he was holding a kid and he had binos spotting us. So he's holding the kid, obviously, so he wouldn't shoot him. Now, I'm allowed to shoot that man, or at least take that shot. Try not to hit the kid, but I can tell you he was at 330 yards and I had an M4, which was basically a 1 minute of angle weapon, which means that if I hold a perfect shot, it's 6 inches plus or minus at that distance. So I didn't take the shot because I didn't want to have a vision of me shooting a kid in my head just in case I missed. Well, later on, we got complex attacked and I end up getting shot on that op.
By that guy, or you don't know?
No, I don't know. No, probably not him. I got shot. We were on our way out when I got shot. So you can argue that had I taken that shot, I would have been fine. I would not have, maybe I accidentally hit the kid. Maybe I would have just nailed it and not hit the kid anyway. But I would have had to live with that the rest of my life. I would have been fine legally because he was a combatant, but I didn't do it ethically because it wasn't the right thing for me. But I also put my whole team in danger. So luckily it was me that got shot and not somebody else, because I think that would be a heavier weight for me to bear. So the combat ethics thing, when I teach it, I tell people, you know, you you have to do what's right first. And sometimes that's not what's legal, because you're going to have to live with those consequences for the rest of your life. That's a heavy burden.
You're saying the standard is above or below what's legal? Or it depends, I guess.
Well, it depends, man. That's the thing about ethics, right? They're all over the place. Ethics, I think at school, they teach ethics as the rules that are going to be happening in the next couple of years. But really, I think ethics is doing what's right, what you think is right. And then if I had a pop tall in front of someone like, why I didn't shoot that guy, I'd be like, this is why. And I reached down, there was a sniper rifle there. I reached down to grab a sniper rifle because I think that I could have made a shot with that one pretty easily. He was gone by the time I got set back up. So.
I've always thought the Sunday paper test is a good threshold. Have you heard that one?
Yeah, just like we were talking about earlier, the Sunday paper spins things. I mean, I can read one Sunday paper that says basically Israel is this terrible aggressor killing people. And I can read another one that says Palestinians are the terrible aggressor.
But I mean, if someone wrote, we were just saying, the factual article of the situation and published it, are you comfortable with it? And you would agree that those were the facts. Are you comfortable with it, or would you be embarrassed by it? Like, I think it's a good barometer, right? When you're making a decision, well, if I just transfer this money for the weekend and put it back, again, if someone were to write the article on that and put it on a Sunday paper, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I've heard that test given to me lots of times, but the masses aren't as much what I care about it as like, could I call my mom and tell my mom? Could I call my brother and tell, these are people that I respect, I want them to respect me. Could I call my brother and tell him this? So I think that's a stronger test, what the whole world thinks about me, which I do what I do, and I try to be a good person. And if you don't align with my values, then I get it. It's okay.
So we hear a lot of talk about public service, particularly maybe in people in government who, well, I appreciate the vast service commitments a lot of people made. I also understand a lot of it's power driven. Talk about the value of kind of humility and service in what you were doing and making that sort of commitment to something beyond yourself. I heard Arthur Brooks speak recently. He's talking about why so many people are struggling. And what was really interesting, he said, look, whether it was religion or whatever it is, you need to, and religion does this, but he was talking with Tim Ferriss about it, who is not religious. He said, you need to make yourself small in relative. As you make yourself too big, there's a lot of struggle there. And you make yourself small and feel like you're part of something bigger. I think that's probably something you had that a lot of people are really missing in society today as a lot of our traditional institutions break down.
I definitely feel like being part of a group that you respect and you work hard. And, you know, people buy into these groups. It's not, you don't get buy-in by the group sacrificing for you. You get buy-in by you sacrificing for that group. Because if you think about like what my parents did for me, they raised me. I call my mom once a week, and it's not the same. But the SEAL teams, what did they do to me? They froze me, got me shot. My friends died. I sacrificed a lot to get into that group. It makes it a more powerful thing for you. I think that there's a lesson there for people who have an organization. The right people in your organization, they're going to come in and work. And the more work they put in, the more bought in they're going to be. But if you just do handouts to people all the time, they're not going to appreciate you. So I know it's counterintuitive, but you look at like the recruiting problems with the military right now, you know who's not having recruiting problems? The SEAL teams, the Marine Corps. You know what the Marine Corps promised you? Nothing. They promise you hard work and suffering.
No signing bonus. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you don't get anything. But you know what? They're not having the same problems because there are people that are coming there for a reason, not for college money or whatever else. And same thing with SEAL teams. You don't come into the SEAL teams because there's easier ways to get money for college. You're coming in because you're there to test yourself, to be part of a really powerful team, something like that. And those are more powerful reasons than college money.
So you talked about before, you can't teach motivation, but I know a passion or something you do focus on teaching is resilience. How do we teach resilience? And obviously, teaching at the leadership level is great. Seems like it should probably start a lot earlier. And we're moving away from resilience. We're moving towards this, my favorite quote now, we're preparing the path for the kids. We're not preparing kids for the path. So where does resilience play a role in all stages of life?
Yeah. So your first question was, how do you teach resilience? It starts off by leaders admitting their failures. That's the first thing you have to do, because people look up at you as a leader and they're like, oh my gosh, Robert's never failed at anything. He's just a super successful podcaster. But when you have an organization, and then if you hold people to a standard where there can be no failure, you're not going to learn anything in that organization and you're not going to teach resilience. People are going to cover up everything that they do wrong. But if you're like, hey, I know this is a hard topic, but my wife had a miscarriage. I mean, that's a huge humanizing thing. And you know what? 1/4 of all pregnancies end in miscarriage. And I'm not a woman, but along those lines, there's a whole lot of like hormones that go on with that. And it's just a super hard struggle. And these women have a hard time with it, but they all cover it up. I get it. You don't want to talk about it. But when you talk about those things that are hard and struggles you had, it opens up everybody else to see like, hey, wait, if Robert is struggling, maybe this my struggles aren't that weird, right? And then it, now you've got this built-in empathy. So now when they have something similar that happens, maybe you had a parent die and you had to go through that. And you told your group, hey, man, my parent died. I need to take a few days off to get affairs settled. And then when you're out there doing that, think about what you're learning at that time. Because now it takes that spotlight off you. Because now you're thinking about, hey, how can I help my teammate? So now 2 years down the road, someone's like, their parent dies. Like, they're like, I'm going to ask Robert about it. And they're like, wait, he's the boss. Like, I know, but his parent died. He's been through this. And now this gives you built-in empathy to kind of teach them, hey, you know what? My dad died. It was hard. We couldn't find his will. He didn't have his stuff squared away. So I had to like talk to my mom and make sure she was taken care of and just kind of give them, walk them through that. And even if you don't have any specific advice that they can use, the fact that they have someone to talk to and bounce stuff off of is going to breed resilience. And then when you task them with like, hey, you know what? While you're going through this, why don't you write down things that are helpful that work out for you so you can help the next person? And now that spotlight's not on them and they're not in that like whirlpool pity party going downhill, but they're actually thinking about how they can use this not a good experience to help somebody else. And I think that's how you get resilience.
Yeah, as you said that, two things came into mind around sort of, obviously the earlier you start this better. One, we seem to be modeling this academic achievement thing where getting anything wrong is bad, which is horrible because the stakes are lower and like you should not think that getting a C or a B is the end of your life. And two, we have this world of social media where you see all of the curated highlights of people's life, the 1% and not the 99% of crap that they deal with on a regular basis.
Yeah, you see Michael Phelps with a bunch of medals around him, but guess what you don't see? Michael Phelps from age 6 to like 24 spending 6 hours a day in a pool. Like, you know, it's just not as good, exciting of TV.
Yeah, and probably quitting or giving up or otherwise.
I mean, just spending all that time staring at that line underneath you in the water. I mean, I swim sometimes. I get super bored. I do it for like 45 minutes. I'm done.
What parental advice would you give parents based on resilience if they want resilient kids?
No, you have to let your kids fail. Don't cover that up for them. If it's not going to hurt them, it's not going to injure them, I let them fail.
Right, I was just going to say physically injure, right?
Yeah, right. If it's not going to physically injure them, then I let them do it. I'll tell him like, hey, I don't think that's a good idea. He'll be like, Dad, I think it is. I'm like, okay, let them do it and let them fail. And then when they fail, instead of like throwing a fit, I don't yell. I'm like, I told you so. No, you're like, what might be a better way to do that?
This is what we're saying, but this is the after action report, right?
Exactly. And like my son's way into fish tank. The fish tank's everywhere right now at the house. It's his thing. And he had to buy this stand. And the stands are pretty robust because fish tanks are heavier than you think they are. And he's like, hey, Dad, can you put this together? I'm like, well, no, you can put it together. I'll show you where the tools are and I'll be out there working out if you need help. And so he got it mostly together by himself. It took him about 3 times as long as it would have taken me.
There's something you learn how to use a tool, an Allen wrench that you've never used. And you learn what an Allen wrench is, right?
Yeah. When he shows people the fish tank, he's like, oh, and I built this whole stand, which is true.
We are depriving our children of these experiences. And again, it is not cruel and unusual punishment to have to assemble a fish tank based on what most people wake up and go through in the world each day.
And you know what? Then there's going to be failure built in. Like he found a fish tank in the alley. We patched it up. It worked fine for a couple months and it started leaking. And so it destroyed his dresser. So we had to like try to repatch it again. It just didn't work. And I'm like, man, well, we have to buy another one. It was $38. But it's like, hey, we tried and Dad can't do everything perfect. I gave it a shot, but it didn't work out. So it's okay.
Yeah. Modeling that, right? Your own mistakes, not perfect. Yeah. All right, last question, Jimmy. I could go on forever. This one's multivariant. I ask everyone. So it could be singular or repeated or professional or personal. But what's a mistake that you've learned the most from?
Oh, well, I know this one. This one's easy, actually. I think I've talked about it before. So my best friend was killed on August 6, 2011. He was shot down over Afghanistan in Extortion 17. I was called into the command at midnight. And they said, bring your blues, which never means good stuff. So I'm on my way there trying to figure out what's going on. And 6 hours later, I'm on a plane to Minneapolis to go tell my best friend's family that he was killed. So I got there and, you know, I made notification to the family, but then I had to go home because I had to go back because I just got back from deployment 2 days earlier. I had to get a surgery because I was pretty dinged up. So I had to go get surgery. So I came back and the command had sent a couple people down to like set the funeral up because it was a town of 600 people and we have 1,500 people showing up at this funeral. So we're sitting there going through that and I'm looking at my spreadsheet. We still had spreadsheets back then. And I'm like, what am I doing? Because I've seen, we have a really involved kind of like a will and last testament before you leave. You'd say who your pallbearers are. You talk about what songs are at your funeral, who's not at your funeral. You talk about all this stuff before you go. I knew the answers to most of these things, but I looked at it. I'm like, figured I'll be a pallbearer, not a pallbearer. I'm like, okay, probably giving his mom a flag and escorting her to her seat. Nope, not doing that either. I'm like, okay, well, I must be speaking then. What's my job? I'm handling the distinguished visitors. So it was a slap in the face to me. I've lived with this guy off and on for 10 years. We're best friends. I'm like, are you kidding me? So I started to get real mad. And as I spun around on my heel to go square this away, I stopped and I got really ashamed of myself. And it's not about me. It's about honoring his memory. And so I shut my mouth and I handled the DVs and I did a good job. And the guys that carried the coffin didn't drop him. And her mom found her seat and got her flag. And the guy that spoke did a better job than I would have done. And I'm not remembered as the jerk that made a big scene because I didn't get recognized for who I was in JT's life. So you know what? JT's parting gift to me was get over yourself. And I'm not going to say that it's a lot of good things came from my best friend getting killed, but I will say that I found that silver lining and that comfort and that JT left me something. So yeah, that's the biggest lesson I learned.
All right, Jimmy, thank you for joining us today. Your journey and insights are truly inspiring, and it's been a pleasure to have a chance to talk through some of your incredible experiences.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, to our listeners, thanks for tuning into the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Jimmy and his many ventures on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to follow the show to be notified about new episodes and have them downloaded to listen automatically. If you're listening in Apple Podcasts, you can simply hit follow on the show overview page or those three little dots in the upper right corner if you're on an individual episode in the app, and then just hit follow. You can also hit follow on CastBox, Spotify, Pandora, or your favorite podcast player. Thanks again for your support. And until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the Podcast Princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.